realest podcast ever. The realest podcast ever.
Y'all's the hater on all of my moves, but now niggas on it. That used to bait me on me and my views, but now niggas on it. I used to tell them I had me a show, but now niggas on it. Her homies on it. Your homies on it. Y'all's the hater on all of my moves, but now niggas on it. That used to bait me on me and my views, but now niggas on it. I used to tell them I had me a show, but now niggas on it. Her homies on it. Your homies on it. The realest podcast ever. The realest podcast ever. The realest podcast ever.
Because I never heard it, honestly, before you hit me up. You hit me up.
It was me.
Okay, I wasn't sure which one.
Oh, yeah. I thought he was asking what were you on. I'm like, yeah, we're on.
We on now.
Yeah. Oh, all right.
Yeah, yeah, we on now. The realest podcast ever, episode 150. I'm your host, C. Diddy.
I am Matt Makes Me Sick.
Today, for this, what is with these headphones, yo?
What do you mean?
They're like choppy.
Oh, no, mine don't sound perfect.
All right, cool. Mine till tear. I'm going to just take them off. Can you hear me? All right, cool. As long as y'all can hear me, that's fine. I'm gonna abandon the I'm gonna go sans headphones today. Episode 150, realest podcast ever. And for today's episode, man, we got a special guest. Y'all know, you know, we've been doing a lot of interviews covering, like, you know, the music scene, people that make the thing go, and the media game, stuff like that. Today we're on the art and culture side of the sphere, and we wanted to. I had a social media conversation about food and restaurants and stuff in Philly. And from that, I became aware of this gentleman. And if one thing we get right in Philly, it's food.
Philadelphia food scene is pretty lit.
It's pretty freaking lit. It's one of the best in the country. And this gentleman, 2020 Esquire Magazine Chef of the Year, 2020 Esquire Magazine Pop-Up of the Year, also one of Time Magazine's 100 People to Watch for 2021. Super duper excited to have him here. Special guest, Chef Omar Tate.
Yo, thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you being here with us today,
Taylor,
brother.
Taylor's really good, man.
Taylor's on point.
We have to take Taylor.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, Taylor's getting a nice salary and an expense account when we blow up, when this
it's going to be New Balances everywhere. Oh, shit.
For sure. So, again, man, we appreciate you being here today with us, man. We can't say thank you enough. You are a major figure in the city, but at the same time, I feel like everybody doesn't necessarily know your story,
right?
And that's the reason why we wanted to make sure that we got an interview with you before you get too far gone and then we can't get you on the phone.
Right, then you're not responding.
Because it's coming. So with that being said, man, you know, whenever we have guests, we like to try to you know, like, start from the beginning, have you tell a little bit of your backstory just to connect to our audience. We have like a different kind of audience than the average podcast. Our audience kind of like encompasses some younger people, like 19, 20 years old, up to like 50, but it's a lot of like professional, working class people, middle management, executives, stuff like that, attorneys,
few
doctors, few gangsters. Yeah. But
gotta have them in there.
Yeah. But you know, everything. So you know, you're somebody that's broken a lot of barriers, being from the city and in the culinary world in general. And you've kind of like redefined what can be accomplished for somebody that's from the inner city, being a chef, being in that culinary world. So I kind of want to start by asking you, where did you grow up and how was your upbringing?
I grew up in Germantown, this neighborhood called The Hollow, like right off
very familiar.
Wayne Avenue, yeah, if y'all familiar with Uptown.
I used to drive 65.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Oh, the bus?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That long ass ride, man. Yes.
The bus?
Yeah. No, I used to take that bus from Germantown to West Philly all the time because my best friend lives in
Oak City.
Yeah. But I grew up in Germantown, single mom, oldest of four. You know, she bought her first house at the age of 24. And so, like, a lot of my resiliency, my backbone comes from my mother. You know what I mean?
Right.
But, you know, I mean, I went to public school, standard stuff. I got bused to a school in the Northeast, and I like to tell people that I pretty much have the equivalent of an eighth grade education, because when I got bused to school in the Northeast, everything I was being taught in middle school, I came back and went to high school at Dobbins.
Okay.
Everything we were being taught in middle school
taught
me the same thing all over again. So, like, a lot of my education is a self-education, self-made education.
Gotcha.
You know, like, growing up in my house, though, my mom made it a strong point to make sure that we read, that we knew our history. You know, my grandparents' generation were Black Panthers from South Philly, so my family migrated from South Carolina to Philly in 1929.
Okay.
And my grandfather, who I never met, he passed at the age of 43, was a Black Panther, and so was my Uncle Harold. My family is like 10 toes deep in Philly. Yeah. My Uncle Butch owns a church in North Philly right now. My other aunt and uncle are deacons, so.
Where is the church at?
Off of Glenwood. It's like, it's across the street from a school in North Philly. I haven't been there in years.
Okay.
Yeah, but, just legacy, man.
So what would you say were maybe like some of the challenges for you, like, you know, growing up, being a teenager in Philly? And how old are you, by the way?
30. I'll be 35 tomorrow.
35. Okay, I'm 38.
Oh, happy birthday. Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, this is right on time.
Yeah, man.
So explain, like, you know, maybe some of the challenges and like the terrain that you had to navigate through being, you know, like a teenager in the 90s and the early 2000s in a city like Philly.
Honestly, stop and frisk. Yeah. that was a big one. I mean, the first time I ever had cuffs on me, I was 14 years old.
Damn.
It was 10 o'clock at night, and the cops pulled up on me and my friends. And they said we were out too late. We violated curfew. So they put us in cuffs and threw us in the back of the car, drove us around, dropped us off at home. And then my mom got fined $25. You know what I mean? That she made me pay for being,
for being outside.
Because I had a job at 14. I mean, I think like the biggest challenge that I think faces a lot of young Black men from the city and even in rural areas around the country is that we're made to be men at a very young age. You know, my father wasn't really in my life. I don't know anyone who had a father in their household that I grew up with. You know what I mean?
Straight up, we had this conversation one day, like around my neighborhood.
Straight up.
Like, shout out K-Rock. We was talking about me, him, and Dickie. And Dickie was like, yo, it's like six of y'all around the way.
Right.
We had your pops in the crib. And dead ass. Like me, K-Rock, Kyle, Duty.
Yo, it's a phenomenon,
like,
right?
Like after that, it's just like, damn, like you really look around the hood and it's just like, yeah, like that shit is real.
Well, I mean, my wife is only the second woman in my life that I've ever met where I had to meet her pops. You know what I mean?
Damn.
So
yeah,
like which, like that says a lot about like how we grow up. I mean, these were 14-year-old boys raising other 14-year-old boys.
Yeah.
My mom was at work all the time. So like that colors a lot of my experience as a teenager.
Right. You know,
the first person I ever knew was murdered. He was 17, I was 14. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So like seeing people on t-shirts, you know, mad early.
Yeah,
you become desensitized to violence, right? And
without
like you can kind
of
see what the legacy and the generational trauma is now in a year like 2021 where like children are literally running the streets murdering other children.
Yo.
Like nothing.
Yo. The crazy part is how much of it gets like you see now.
Mm-hmm.
The videos, the ring cameras, the door cameras. I saw one the other day. It just like broad daylight mayhem.
Yeah.
Like this shit is nuts.
I mean, social media, right? Like you look at pages like No Gun Zone and 911 Philly, like it makes you think that that's all that's happening. Like if that's your media that you're consuming, it makes you think that that's all that's happening in
you
the
just
city.
Made me think about it. So I started this new documentary. It's called Trial by Media. Have you seen that on Netflix? And then y'all seen it? You seen it? So each episode basically covers like a big issue that happened in our lives, but showing how the media, you know,
shape the perception of
who did this or who did what, or they made this guy out to be a hero but he wasn't, or made these kids out. And one of the situations is about the subway shooter from 84, the white guy that shot the four Black kids, saying they were trying to rob him, but turns out they were like chilling and he just was on some like
I'm shooting niggas
today. You know what I'm saying? And long story short, the guy who was one of the head journalists for the New York Times, he said that around that time, like 82, 83, he's like, if you look at the news from before 82, 83, the news that came on the television was like positive. He's like, and then in journalism, there was like an unwritten rule where if it bleeds, it leads.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how like the 80s shifted to where now when the news comes on, three people shot over here, four people killed down here, three people got tied. Right. Like that's all it is. So it's like I tell people a lot of times, I don't even follow them pages just because it's too negative.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
that isn't all that's happening. And the flower show, like it's all kinds of dope shit going on. But if you go on that page, you will really think that it's just cars driving up on the porches, people running into houses with axes and tomahawks. It's just like, no, that's really not it, man. Mm-hmm. I had a cheesesteak the other day. Shit was real talk. Like, you really will believe that that's all that's happening in Philadelphia.
Right.
So, yeah, I totally understand what you're saying.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. It's really crazy.
Lean in for me.
Oh, yeah, my fault. Trying to lean back.
But people always do it. They get comfortable, get cool.
You can lean back, but we go ahead and
take the mic with you.
But no, like you said, it's crazy. So like I'm really happy that a podcast like this don't exist, because
thank you.
You know, this is this is what's needed, you know, especially like, again, like positive black men doing something really dope with their lives. You know what I mean?
It throws me off. Like when I have older people come up to me, like, I love the podcast. I'll be like, yeah.
How
like,
you find this, Jones?
Yeah.
Who sent you?
Right. But no, that's definitely decent. I appreciate that a lot.
So tell me this. Where did your passion for cooking come from? Considering all of those different socioeconomic circumstances that existed.
I didn't have a passion for it. So I was taught to cook because my mom was working. Okay. And so my brother, Kasim, we're 18 months apart. Mm. So she taught us very young, one, we're not going to depend on a woman to feed ourselves, but also we have two younger brothers that we needed to help feed and stuff like that. So I actually didn't like cooking because it was taught to me as like a means to survival. You know what I mean? So it's like a chore. And I actually started cooking because I lied on a resume. I lied on a resume. I worked at the Philadelphia Marriott at the convention center for like 2.5-3 years as an overnight porter and a dishwasher, and I was just getting money, like doing my thing, whatever, I didn't care. But I was out of a job, and I used to sell drugs or whatever. So when I was out of a job, I was selling drugs. But I always wanted to keep a job while I was hustling. I wasn't a good drug dealer by any means. Just
you putting just, that up. Just going through the motions.
I mean, look, man, like it was easy. It supplemented my income. It let me go to like dumbass restaurants like Copa. You know, take my girlfriends out, make it look like I had money. I rent cars and do dumb stuff.
Yeah.
But I got fired from the Marriott. Because
this is the best interview of all time.
Because that's really like the mentality of a young drug dealer. Man, I'm getting money. I'm going to the fucking 5-star restaurant. Yo,
I got the big ass margaritas. Oh,
it was stupid, man. It was stupid. So I got fired because I didn't respect my job. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I leveraged the proximity that I had to chefs and cooks at the Marriott as a dishwasher to say, yeah, I did some prep work on an application. That was at a golf club called Rivercrest Golf Club in Phoenix, like 30 miles outside of the city.
Yeah.
And the funny story is, so this is how I got the job. In between the Marriott, I had a job at a Hilton hotel in Paoli.
Okay.
And I got fired from there too because I was late every day.
Right.
But the dude was like, "Yo, I really appreciate your work ethic, but I just can't keep you on because you're late. But if you ever need anything, you know." Hit me up. No one ever means that.
Right.
So I hit him up.
Right. What's up?
And all I needed was to use that same space as a place to catch a taxi to get to Phoenixville because at the time I was told that there was no public transportation out there.
Okay.
So I take a luxury taxi. It's Ramadan. I was raised Muslim. It was Ramadan, so I was acknowledged Ramadan. I had $25 in my pocket. They order me a taxi, but the taxi shows up and it's a luxury car, not a taxi. So I'm like, all right. So I get in this joint, and the dude is Muslim. So we're riding up there, and I'm just watching the ticker go up, And when it hits,
this gonna be bad.
So at like $24, like, yo, brother, listen.
When he puts it in park, you like, hold you.
No, he never parked it. That's the beautiful thing of the story. He never parked it. We were talking about Ramadan and Islam and fasting the whole time. And then when it got to $24, I told him like, yo, listen, I'm going up for a job interview. I got $25 in my pocket. This is all I got. If you could just get me there, I'll give you all $25. And I'll just figure out how to get home. So he said, okay, we get to the golf club. And he said, you know what, brother? Like, I'm gonna get blessings if I drop you off. You're obviously here for a reason. You were willing to give me everything you got. You keep it. I'm going to receive blessings for this. Happy Ramadan, right? So I get off, nailed the interview. They asked me to start tomorrow. And I said, I can't because I got family obligations. But really, I needed to figure out how I was going to get there.
Yeah.
I leave the golf club. I walk back out to the road where the taxi dropped me off at. And I turn around and there's a bus. Remember, I said there was no buses that come out here.
Right.
I get on the bus number 99 that comes from Camille Crusher out to Phoenixville. And I was like, yo, I thought there were no buses. I paid to get on. He said, oh, today's the first day of the route.
Mm-hmm.
So, So like it felt like, you know, divinity. You know what I mean? So I got that job that day, had a way to work. I worked there for a year and a half. And then after that, I just worked at the best restaurants in Philly for the next 5 years and then moved to New York after that.
What are some of the restaurants that you worked at in Philly? If you don't mind name dropping.
Yeah, that's cool. I worked at Fork, a place that's no longer there called Russet. I worked at Budokan.
Okay.
It's my spot.
I started at Le Bec Fin for a little bit.
I was about to say Le Bec Fin was at one of them, yeah.
I didn't work there for a long time. I just staged there. I mean, that place was wild.
Yeah.
It was wild. I mean, I dealt with a lot of stuff in my career, just like in hindsight, you don't. Sometimes you don't realize that shit is racist until you look back.
You look back like that was racist.
That was some racist shit.
Oh, no, I'm walking about.
Where's the racist? It is
right there.
But cooking is weird. It's almost like the military when you're working at that level. Because this is fine dining. People don't really realize how many.
It's real regimented, right?
Right. Like how many different distinctions are. It's not like. McDonald's is a restaurant, but people don't look at it as a restaurant. It's almost like this public utility at this at a certain point.
Like there's food and then there's fine dining.
Right. So this fine dining is kind of like the military. You go in there and like you're completely removed of self-identity. So it's like almost hard to recognize extreme cultural signals from any end of the spectrum. So like it really took a long time for me to recognize things that were fucked up, you know? I don't regret any of it, but Le Bec Fin was one of those kitchens where I walked in and I was like, wait a minute. This is fucked up. They produce some extremely good and talented cooks that are still, you know, around in the city right now, but the culture was just not for me. So I only I worked there for free for a few days out of the week for a couple weeks.
Yeah.
But it was also the most beautiful dinner service that I've ever seen in my life. Like a great dinner service almost looks like a symphony, man. Like you don't have to speak. There's the people are moving in like a dance kind of way.
Yeah.
And
it's artistic.
Yeah, it's very, very beautiful, man. It's almost like a ballet. So that was great. But where else did I work? A bunch of places. Yeah. There was one time where I held three jobs at once. One was at Friends Central School. I was the chef at a private school. And then I was
one on 16th Street?
That joint right there off the Parkway.
Yeah.
I worked there for a month because I only worked there because I wanted my son to go to a private school.
It's crazy to think that Friends Central had an actual chef.
They, yeah. I don't think that they really wanted that. They,
old white lady
dropping mashed potatoes.
Look. So that's like the weird thing about that school. There are no old white ladies who work in the kitchen. Everything about that school is white until you get to the kitchen, which is almost historically accurate to anything that ever existed in the food business and food industry in America. It's almost always black and sometimes brown behind the curtain.
I swear to God, I was watching one of Paul Mooney older stand-ups the other day, and he was saying how, you know what throws me off the most when I turn on the cooking channel, the Food Network?
Mm-hmm.
He's like, it's white people cooking. These motherfuckers cooking. Real shit. He's like, you were slaving that like they cook boiled water. It's like, now they all got cooking shows and shit, but it's just like,
Wow. That school was run by three black women, an older black man, and then myself at that time. I worked there for a month because I wanted my son to have the opportunity to go to this really nice school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then I learned that we were all hired by contract outside of the school. So
that didn't even transfer
people
over.
Who couldn't get benefits at this school or benefit from the school were the kitchen workers who were 100% African American.
No. Like it really is a
it's everywhere.
What'd you say, Tyler? Am I hearing this right now? Like, yo, real talk. Like,
they're serious. Yeah. They're serious. So I mean that was one, but
damn.
I was doing that and working two jobs and I went to community college for 2 months all at the same time. But I mean, I really wanted, I felt like being a chef could define me. And then ultimately, when I moved to New York, I realized that definition wasn't even really who I was in the first fucking place. So I didn't need that title anymore. So now I really look at myself as a fully encompassed artist, you know?
Mm. So through all of those experiences, did you kind of begin to like gain a passion or appreciation for the art, like the culinary arts, or did it still just kind of like, you just a job and I'm just like here?
Oh no, it was day one that I realized that this was something that I really wanted.
Okay.
So that first day that I started at the golf club, they asked me to brunoise shallot, and I didn't know what either one of those words meant. But what I did know was that both of those words were possibility into a world that I never even knew existed. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like growing up, my mom cooked all the time, but she used what she knew, you know? And she was a very curious person. She would bake, and like I said, we were raised Muslim, and so she would adopt like Middle Eastern flavors and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
She was a nutritionist and a physician who taught black women health and exercise for free at the community center and ran a couple of gyms and stuff. So there was a point where we were vegetarian, but again, it was like kind of within the framework of the things that she already understood.
Yeah.
So when I went into the kitchen and like learned what a shallot was, which is a small, like sweeter onion,
mm-hmm.
Learned about fennel and leeks and like all these things that I'd never seen before, but kind of show up in food in ways that we don't know all the time and different ways and places and spaces. I was like, oh, this piques my curiosity, you know, because I've always been into
it. It is crazy, but you 35 years old and you still just be finding out like, what is that? Oh, all right. It tastes all right.
Yeah,
like,
mm-hmm. I had that 14 times.
Yeah.
Don't even realize it.
Yeah. Seriously. I mean, but that's, you know, that's the thing about cultural exchanges. You know, as much as I love and embody and exude black culture, like humans' nature is to communicate. We're global people, especially in a place like America where they say it's a melting pot,
right?
You know, in a city like Philadelphia that has like probably one of the most complex ethnographic makeups of the entire country. It's just how can we not be curious? You know?
Yeah. How would you describe your style as a fully accomplished culinary artist?
Style is a tough question. I mean, I think in practice, I start from history usually, and then I use history to bridge contemporary themes. Like, I mean, for example, a dish that Honeysuckle, which is the name of the pop up. Right. I don't think we said it.
No, not yet.
One of the dishes is called Clorindy, and the dish is actually named after a theater production that was produced by Paul Laurence Dunbar and William Cook,
mm-hmm.
where the play Clorindy was acted in by black actors in 1898 who wore blackface.
Okay.
And so the dish itself was conceptualized over a meal of raw beef, bell peppers, onions, and beer. And I used that as the basis for a beef tartare and coated the beef tartare as like a surf and turf that had squid ink in it. And so using that history to bring forward a more modern application of what food is, like this beef tartare, using black history as the foundational aspect.
That's amazing.
You're way past crab meat. like these Philly shows.
Ain't no old man. Yeah.
You know, Philly, you ain't had crab meat on rice Krispies. Like, you way past all that. I've had tuna tartare. I haven't had beef tartare, though.
It's a very French thing. Yeah. And usually it's made with cornichons and Dijon.
Okay.
Shallots, typical French shit.
Right.
And to kind of turn that on its head and make it a very black thing, but also a not black thing, because it's a dish in and of itself that just exudes the nature of black creativity.
Yeah, the thing really with chefs, at least the Philly chef, is like they get like one thing and then just kind of like everybody. Like, remember we talking about the Thai chili?
Yeah.
Like that Thai chili is just...
It's permeated the culture.
Yeah, it's just everywhere now. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, yeah, like that explanation was like, I got to try this.
Specific to chefs and... this not even on my list, but specific to chefs and chefing, can you explain the difference in, like, the kitchen hierarchy to people? Because it's a lot of people out here that's just cooks that think they're a chef.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the same thing.
Like the people that get on my bus with the big boots. They ain't chefs.
You ain't a chef. Nah. You're a cook. You work in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Most chefs, like, executive chefs, are not working the line cooking. Right. Chefs are generals.
Yeah, they're just like yelling at people.
Yeah, well, right. And throwing plates and cussing people the fuck out.
You're like,
no, I mean, a lot.
Like, whoa, why can't I just be an ass? Why can't I be an ass? Like, what's going on here?
I mean, a lot of that stopped, but like most chefs are generals. They're telling people what to do. They're monitoring food costs and things like that, materials and equipment and stuff like that. Chef de cuisines and sous chefs monitor the day-to-day aspects of what the line cooks do, and the executive chefs monitor that middle management. So a chef de cuisine or a sous chef might also work the line, but also take some of that labor off of the executive chef with the numbers and figures and ordering and things like that.
So who's the head person cooking then?
The head person cooking?
Yeah.
People always say it's the executive chef, and sometimes it's true, but most times it's not. It's mostly the line cooks that work hourly that are executing all the food that you enjoy at restaurants.
Right, but they're being given a set of directives from that middle management that's coming from the executive chef.
And the sous chef is under the line.
No, the sous chef is middle management.
Okay.
So chef de cuisines and sous chefs are middle management, and then the executive chef is upper management.
Okay.
And then to get like even more granular in like these higher fine dining kitchens, the line cooks themselves are separated in delegation as well, where like a chef de partie is the head of a cooking station. So like if there was a crab station, for example, there could be two or three cooks working the crab station because it's that intricate, and a chef de partie would be like their general for that specific line. So it gets really
a lot of minutiae,
like a special teams coach for a special team,
basically. Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Right.
Damn.
Yeah.
It's a lot of. a lot of muck.
Right. And then when you sit down, you get this play, you like, man, that shit was good. And then right. you leave, right?
All you think about.
And then you don't know about all this stuff happening in the background, you know? So
yeah, like you're like a Outback. It's just like, you know, guys.
Oh, no, Outback ain't like that.
Yeah.
Outback has a dude with a chef coat and a clipboard that tells people to press the buttons on the microwave.
Yeah.
That's what they do. And people are real good at pressing those buttons.
That's crazy. So we broached the name. We talked about it, Honeysuckle Projects. What's the overall mission behind Honeysuckle Projects and the collective that you have? Because it's past just about being about food.
Mm-hmm.
It's bigger than that.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, it started out as, you know, the pop-up experience that coalesced art, literature, and food, because I'm a practicing artist and I write poetry. So those meals would include people sitting down. They get a booklet that had the poetry and art, where the names of the poetry and art shared the same names as the menu items.
Awesome.
But that kind of pivoted and evolved through COVID, and my wife and I are working on a project called Honeysuckle Provisions, which is a larger project that's going to open up in the hood in West Philly,
nice.
where we live right now.
Yeah.
And that project is going to be anchored in a grocery store, a meat market, and a cafe library. We're marketing it as a community and communal space, because, you know, community centers and grocery stores used to be community centers.
Right.
People come, they have relationships with their grocer or their butcher or whatever. And it was a very neighborly thing. Yeah, and there was also an educational aspect.
You would know who's coming and going, the comings and goings of the neighborhood, et cetera. It was center.
Mm-hmm. Like, dead. Mm-hmm. I remember going to the market with my mom, and like dead ass, like, the lunch meat guy, like, knew her.
Right.
You know, like, the guy who worked the seafood counter, like, knew her.
Mm-hmm.
The woman who worked in the like you said, at the meat part of it.
Butcher station,
the butcher station, like, knew. Yeah, it just, that is wild.
And, like, we don't really, we kind of take that relationship for granted, because not only do you trust that person.
We really don't have, like, a community, though.
Not anymore.
Yeah, not anymore. That's what I'm saying.
And that's the thing that Honeysuckle's trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, Honeysuckle Provisions is going to be the reestablishment of community and behaviors that we have with people that service our food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not only is it important from a nutritional standpoint, but from a cultural standpoint, like all the things that exist in Black communities right now. Like, if you look at, I read a statistic that said if Black America was its own country, it would be a third world country. You know, and right. So like it's constantly exploited. There's almost no ownership, and land rights just aren't really a thing in Black communities. And so all of that's been disrupted historically and systemically throughout America. And what Honeysuckle's trying to do is reestablish that identity and purpose as entrepreneurs, not just being your neighbors, but also being educators and propagators of positivity and ownership in our community. So, yeah, I guess that's the overarching thing,
right,
which
right,
is still
right,
a lot.
Right, right. So what's the timeline for everything to be up and running?
By the end of the year.
End of the year,
By the end of the year is the goal.
I saw y'all, you have GoFundMe organized for, is it for that project or for
it's for real estate.
Okay, got it.
Mm-hmm. It's for real estate. So the GoFundMe, we set at 250. Right now we're just over 115,000.
That's beautiful.
Which is, yes.
Because I was looking through your social media, and I'm looking at it, and I've seen, like, at one point, like, it wasn't that much amount of time, but it had jumped from, like, 40-something to, like, close to 100, like, in a pretty short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's obvious that people, you know, are supporting and believing the overall vision of what you're trying to bring to life, and I just thought that was very, very encouraging.
Thank you, man.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Let's talk about some.
I was gonna ask, do you have like influences as far as cooking? Like, do you have
tons?
Okay, like
tons of influences. My main influence is a woman who's pretty much like the grand dame of Southern cooking, Edna Lewis, who a lot of people don't know about, but she was a chef and restaurateur in New York for about 40 years. But she was born and raised in a town called Freetown, Virginia, that was established by her grandparents' generation just after emancipation. And she wrote a book called A Taste of Country Cooking that was a beautifully written, nostalgic treatise on her experience as a Virginian. And she brought all of that with her through her cooking. So she's the main one.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. George Washington Carver is another one. John Coltrane's another one.
Okay.
and like the thought and philosophy of like how he creates. And I mean, I have peers who encourage me every day. Kurt Evans, who owns this place called Down North Pizza.
Yeah. You know Kurt very well.
Oh, okay.
He's a good friend of ours. Yeah, nice. He's supposed to come here, but he don't like us no more.
No?
I'm kidding.
I'll hit him up. No, I'll hit him. Trust me. I'll text him right now.
Yeah. It's going to end up.
You know what I'm saying? To the pizza.
Yeah.
There's this cat named Johnny Rose in Houston who started his own farm and had a spot called Indigo. Okay. In Houston, Greg Collier has this place called Leon Louise in Charlotte. There's a bunch of,
yeah.
I mean, I could go on and on and on, man.
I want to learn how to cook.
Yeah.
Like, no, I'm not. I was saying it yesterday. Like, mm-hmm. Cooking is just, you know, I'm a nigga. You know what I'm saying? I just some Obey and salt, everything.
Little garlic salt.
Everything. Salt, pepper, what was it? Salt, pepper, onion powder, and garlic. That's like, that's
everything.
That just handles everything. But I'm dead as I respect cooking. Like, when mm-hmm. you can actually, like, create,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can feel the what they say, the love in the food mm-hmm. and all. Like,
you can
know.
Tell a story with cooking also. Mm-hmm.
Well, wait, what's your, on a date, what's your go-to, if you had to make something, what's your go-to?
I'm really good at making, like, the Tuscan salmon. That's become, like, my thing. You know what I'm saying? Once I found out what heavy cream was, I lost my mind. We're cooking. I actually did lobster tails recently. Mm-hmm. Like, I did them myself. I bought the little pans and, you know, butterflied them. And, you mm-hmm. know, it was a thing. You know what I'm saying?
You're trying, man.
But now I want to be able to, like, just, you know, this is my... What's the Thai shit I like? The red curry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like mm-hmm. this is my red curry shrimp. what I prepare for you today is like, I want to be able to do that, but I just can't cook. I tried when I was young, my mom, but you mm-hmm. know, older black people, it's like, you in the way.
Right.
You know,
right,
they
right,
were
right,
regimented
right.
and what
yeah,
they
yeah, mm-hmm. like I remember I was going to help her make Sunday dinner, and like I went, she had like a cabinet with like in our dining room with all these books, like cookbooks and mm-hmm, shit, mm-hmm. but she never really like used them. they don't need.
Well, you know,
shit.
Older black people just be having shit just to have it in the crib. That's why they got that the China exactly. cabinet that you can't touch. You right. can't touch the shit. So.
It's baby shoes.
What is the functional usage right. of anything in here?
We quickly turn it into one of those older black people.
It was a glass cabinet in the dining room that had all these cookbooks in it. So I remember I forgot what we were making, but I went to go get the cookbooks mm-hmm. and I brought them in the kitchen. My mom was like, yeah, out.
You done.
Yeah, you done.
Gordon,
yeah, Gordon, yeah. Because it's just like you in the way more than anything. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I never really learned how to like cook.
Mm.
So I respect cooking.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
anything yeah. past like dropping wings in the fryer, you know, like it's just, all right, you know what you're doing. Like, that shit it's respectable. Like it's respectable craft.
Well, I mean, get back into the books, man. I mean, YouTube's a great resource.
You not know? Everything I do, like, I literally go, white ladies tell you to do it on YouTube. It's just like, when I poured the Ninja Foodie, that's how I got into that.
So,
like,
your food is bland then? That's what you're, yeah, that's what you're telling me?
No. I'm not with the sauce. I go get some of the hickory brown sugar, I tear it up in there. But no, it's like, I just, like you said, go on YouTube, mm-hmm. see something. But I mean, like, being able to just do it.
Yeah.
Like, I can walk in.
For muscle memory.
You mm-hmm. ever watch the show where they open up the basket and it's like, you know, a plunger, a piece of octopus, and, you know what I'm saying? Just stupid shit. And they'll all make meals out mm-hmm. of just nothing. Like, right. that shit is just
yeah,
respectable.
That's magic.
Yeah.
That's magic.
Yeah.
They say that men make the best cooks. Agree mm-hmm. or disagree?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Cooking is a matriarchal act. You know? So, like, I think men have, like, strong technical sense and tactile nature towards things because men just don't think about things holistically, and so that doesn't necessarily make it better.
Right.
It just makes it streamlined. And women just have this nurturing gift of cultivating love that food needs to be the best that it can possibly be. So absolutely not.
That's probably the best answer to a question.
No, that's real shit. That's real shit. Like, your mom could dead ass boil hot dogs. She did something to this water. My dad boiled hot dogs. Like, man, they boiled hot dogs. Like, but your mom knew right. It is mm-hmm. like, yeah.
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 Yeah, man.
You can feel it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My
your mom give you a glass of water. You like,
Because like, because she gave you that glass of water at the right time.
Right. Yeah.
That's, it's not even about the water.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's the extension.
That's a perfect way to describe
that's
it.
That's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is the best answer we've ever gotten on this
in history. Bar none. Let's
Most our guests are rappers, so when you ask them shit,
man, you know, I'm just doing my thing.
You feel
you
me?
Know?
I'm trying.
Dragging on these niggas.
Shout out, Poppy. Feel me? I'm saying.
Let's talk about some of the pop up projects that you've done with like different restaurants and collectives and stuff like that.
Okay.
How would you if you had to rank them? What would you say are like your top three pop ups that you did?
Man, I don't know. That's tough. I think the best pop up that I did is the most recent engagement that I had with Blue Hill in New York.
I saw that.
Stone Barns. But that's because over 4 years I've been doing a pop up like pretty much on my own.
Okay. Right?
And in that engagement, first of all, I got to thank my wife. She was with me every step of the way, pregnant and everything, helping me do all the stuff.
Yeah.
But then also there's an army of professional cooks at the top of their game. I mean, this restaurant is perennially one of the best restaurants in the world, ranked on these different platforms. And everyone who works there is there for a purpose. And for them to create that environment for me where people can take all of my ideas and turn them all into 100 to 1,000%. Made that the best and probably, in my opinion, probably the most important dining experience in recent American history.
Wow.
Outside of that,
you give amazing answers.
You're artists.
Yeah, real talk.
It's hard to rank them because they're all so different. You know, we did do one called Black Labor Day, my wife and I, last year, where we set up shop right in the middle of West Philly, like at 42nd and Parrish, in an empty lot where we cooked the whole goat over wood coals and served four different meals in a box that cost $100 for several different guests. And then people showed up from outside of our community, bought their boxes. But then we also gave boxes to our neighbors and stuff just for free because, you know, the people who were coming were mostly like white folks who follow me on Instagram or whatever.
Right.
just, you know, a mixed bag of people. And my neighbors were super curious. And we made enough because I knew that they would be.
Yeah.
So as soon as we set up the grill, you know, niggas come out the woodwork, right? They're like, man, I've been here for 40 years, man. What the fuck you doing? Yeah, whatever. So gaining trust, you know, is something I think is important. And planting roots in Philadelphia after having been away for so long, doing a pop-up like that called, you know, Black Labor Day is a holiday that we created that happens before Labor Day.
Right.
That acknowledges the agricultural and economic influence that black labor has helped, has not helped, but is responsible for creating this American opulence that we live in. So we took a bunch of different ingredients like rice, coffee, indigo, cotton, and they were all represented in sugarcane, all represented in some way within this box and in every dish. And then the boxes were collages of indigo and coffee and rice. And so that was a really beautiful one. But all the other ones that were like the multi-course ones, they were almost the same and equal because they're so thematic and have different perspectives in each one.
Gotcha.
I can't get over this nigga isn't answering things.
A machine.
I'm gonna train myself to do that. Like, yo, Matt, what's your favorite sneaker of the year? You first have to ask yourself, what is this? And what is the purpose of the sneaker? You know, and I'm like, that shit is.
This is probably gonna be a tough question, but what are you most proud of in your culinary career so far?
So far, my son's Bashir. He's 14 years old. And like the first thing that I ever said to him that I was gonna, like, in his ear, I prayed Shahada in his ear. I told him I would never leave him, and the last thing I said was I would give him a skill. And so the thing that I'm most proud of is that I've worked really hard to get to the point where I am, where like not only am I going to be able to give him a skill, and my wife's pregnant, so Jupiter is his name.
Yeah.
They're both going to have skills and a business and a farm to step onto that's theirs.
That's beautiful.
That's.
This nigga.
I mean, you had people, you know, you had
I'm really corny as shit. That's
not having a death. I'm like,
dog.
No, not at all, man.
You had people like you know, like Dame Dash that speak a lot about you know, legacy and like, you know, hustling for your last name and not your first, and you know, being able to pass something to you know, to your children. So that's, you know, that's somebody that we, you know, we champion a lot on this show as far as like his ethos and, you know, maybe not all his business tactics, but
yeah.
I watched the episode of the Dame Dash show the other day on YouTube. Did you ever see that?
No.
He had like people competing to be like his intern.
Oh shit.
Yeah. And he sat them all at like a big round table, like a big, you know, a conference table. And he was sitting at the end. He was like, "You're born and you die. Your life is the dash." I'm like, Dame is crazy.
Yo, that's bars.
Dame is crazy as shit. And I'm like, yo, your life really is the dash.
Real shit.
I'm like, Dame is nuts.
I was at a funeral, and a preacher said something to the similar effect. He was like, you gotta focus on that dash. Yo. Like, He was going in about the dash.
Your life is the dash.
But I bring that up because you're probably the first person that we've had on the show. We had a lot of guests on the show. We had lawyers, elected officials, all that to talk about like legacy and the fact of like being able to give your children something tangible and being able to give them a skill, give them a farm, a business, all of that. And that's how we create, you know, how we create generational wealth. And sustainability within the family structure of being able to know, like, at 14, your son knows this is what I got to look forward to. I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, that's decent.
Yeah, man. Yeah, doing the work out here, man. Trying.
For sure. Let's talk about some of these accolades. How did it feel when you found out that you won not only Esquire's Pop Up of the Year, but also Chef of the Year?
Man. So I was at a supermarket with my wife. We were shopping.
This is about to be good. And, about to knock your socks off.
We were looking for olive oil, actually. I remember exactly what happened because, you know, we were walking. She was talking to her mom, and I got a phone call from Jeff Gordon-Yer, who at the time was the food editor of Esquire. He came to a Honeysuckle pop-up in New York. And he was like, you know, I'm just calling to tell you you're going to be Chef of the Year, but you can't tell nobody. And I'm like, all right. So like, I can't.
What the fuck you mean you can't tell nobody? Tell everybody. Right? Yeah.
So, I mean, I was mad excited. I told my family. But, like, that award, it's kind of like I was surprised and happy, but also, like, it felt deserved. You know what I mean?
Because you did the work.
I did the work, right? So, like, if you're playing basketball and you're Michael Jordan and then, like, you're playing your ass off so you could become MVP and then you become the MVP, you can be like, yo, I can't believe it. Like, why don't you believe it? You were fucking working your ass off.
Right.
You know, so, like, that's kind of how it felt. But also, you know, given the climate of last year, 2020, and, like, not to take anything away from this award or Jeff Gordon-Yer, who's, like, a great dude, but I also understand that, like, the world shifted. The way we consume things, the way that we honor people changed, who we're honoring changed. There's a huge overcorrection of, like, just making everything black. You know what I mean? Like, hey, which is great and also, like, really uncomfortably interesting at the same time.
And a little bit of pandering going on.
Exactly. And so, like, if I'm being 100% honest and transparent, like, when I got that award, I was like, but really, though? You know, do y'all really think that I'm a chef?
Am I really the chef of the year?
Right. And, I mean, I am, because I felt, you know, the work that I've done qualifies me for it. But if none of this was going on, am I in that conversation? You know what I mean? So,
were you the first black to win the award?
No.
Okay.
No. There was another chef, I think 2 years prior, Kwame Onuwache, who won it. But, like, my cynical ass just, like, you know, makes me
like,
think
did
those
I
things.
Win or did I win?
Like,
win.
If I'm being 100% honest, like, I just I battle, like, all sorts of, like, imposter syndrome and insecurity and all that kind of stuff, and I think that has a lot to do with the challenges of my upbringing.
A little bit of, like, a pessimist.
A little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, I kind of what happened afterwards was, like, it doesn't matter. You know, it's given me the opportunity to speak from this position in the way that I think others who may have won this award would not speak from. Like,
absolutely.
I'm not here to bullshit nobody. You know what I mean? Like, the work that I do is Afrocentric. It's Black American centric. It is focused on the acknowledgement of our existence and joy, pain, pleasure in all forms. Period. You know what I mean? So, like, I like to equate the work that I do to a musician, to like I said, like John Coltrane or like Kendrick Lamar, who are also huge influences on how I perceive my work, or writers like James Baldwin, who is another big influence, Ta-Nehisi Coates. You know, like, these people are doing exemplary work and they're being recognized internationally, but that's also at the same time Like the word unapologetic is often used, but like it's beyond that. It just is, right. You know, because that's what every other, that's what white people get to do. They just get to show up white.
Just
right?
Exist.
This is like Umar with a spatula. It's crazy. Man.
You know, so I felt like it was a great way for me to celebrate myself, but then also be ubiquitous and magnanimous in the way that I get to share that with my community.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Another scenario, Time Magazine's 100 people to watch for 2021.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that experience, where you was when you found out and what type of doors something like that has opened for you.
Well, that's the one where I cried. Like it was a single tear, but so at that time, I was sleeping on my mom's floor. Like I moved back to Philly. March 17th of 2020, I was like pretty much sleeping on my mom's floor. It's a comfortable floor,
yeah,
it's a floor.
Floor nonetheless.
And I had like a really hard day that day doing, I can't remember what I was doing, but it was 10 after midnight. And actually the person from Time had sent me that email like 4 days prior with a cryptic email that said, oh, we want you to work on a project with us or something like that. I'm like, whatever, right?
Yeah.
And then when I responded, they were like, well, actually, we're naming you on the Time 100 Next list. And I was like, what? Like, that's the one that I didn't expect. You know, like, for this work that's, you know, food-centric, culture, like, you know,
yeah,
culturally relevant, but internationally recognized as something progressive that should be watched and continue to be followed for years to come is like, wow, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as a result of these accolades and things that you got, are there like random white people trying to give you money and stuff now? Like just like trying to invest in, you know, the Honeysuckle brand and into, you know, Omar Tate specifically? Has your life changed as a result of all of these accolades?
Yes and no. Yes and that. Like it's not even just random white people. So it's all sorts of people coming out of the woodwork being interested in what I'm doing. But also at the same time, I think that what I do is perceived as radical for a lot of people.
Gotcha.
You know, there are black people that really I didn't really recognize that it was like this because I'm living it. But like, I guess I speak from a confidence or like a sense of like internal empowerment that I think is scary to a lot of people. Scary to a lot of like brands don't come at me.
A little too self-aware.
Yeah, you know what I mean. Like there's an honesty that you know that I come to this work with that I think it kind of just like kind of scares some people. So
right.
It's open doors for people who are open to that, and then just like I guess the same doors that have been closed are closed because of how open
they super close now.
probably. Yeah. But I mean, look, honestly, like I don't give a fuck. Like because the thing is, like the work that I'm doing, is going to be defined by the parameters that I'm building it with. You know,
right.
It's going to it has to have this architecture.
You made me think about the Olympics. You know, you can't wear the Black Lives Matter shirts. The Olympics.
Really?
Yeah, they put out a thing the other day. They banned the Black Lives Matter shirts. And if you get on the podium and do a fist or kneel,
mm-hmm.
you grounds for a suspension and all this other stuff.
Wow.
I'm just like, damn. Like the Olympic Committee put that out, though. I was just like, damn.
And they're like, yeah, get back.
Well, that's
line.
The bullshit I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Like, what? Like, all these things have been built, right? Like,
right.
The Olympics, the Oscars, the NFL, whatever. We're living in a time where there's more like consolidated black money, black influence. If we really pay attention to what's going on in the world, blackness and black culture is the bar, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely.
So like, obviously it's going to take a long time to like build all our own stuff. But instead of like saying, please, please, please give me an Oscar. Just like fuck it.
Let's build our own.
You know what I mean? Like that's what we were doing when we had less power, you know, boycotting stuff and doing this.
But the problem is like when we do the awards, no one comes and you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's like people don't take it as serious.
Right.
What do you think would need to happen for people to take it more serious? Like to respect these black institutions of success more than what they already are? Like
a lot of them happen by mirroring white culture. You know what I mean? Like, the Black Oscars. For, like, you know, the, people would call it the Black Oscars. Like, no, it's something entirely different.
Yeah, it's its own
like,
thing.
You know, like, I think about things like the Black Power movement, right, in the 1970s, you know, when so many different, like, the Black Arts movement and so many different entities, like Soul Train, for example, is the blackest thing that ever happened in television
right.
history.
Right.
It had nothing to do with American Bandstand. It had nothing to do with fucking Dick Van Dyke or whoever the fuck, you know. Yeah. It didn't have nothing to do with nothing.
But everyone
other than
was there.
Everyone was there. And what it did was, beyond it just being like a very black thing, it drew the world at right. large into it, like, and even, made it a staple.
Even when you look at like the Grammys, you know, the Grammys come around, and I mean, like, Drake and Rihanna and mm-hmm. Beyonce and mm-hmm. Jay-Z and all of these, Kanye, all these people are there.
Mm-hmm.
When the hip hop awards come around, you know who's the biggest artist there? It's DaBaby. And he's dressed like the Riddler. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's the
Niggler.
The Niggler. Like that. So it's like you'd have to get everyone to be a part of it.
Right.
If that happens, mm-hmm. yeah. That's the truth. That's what it is. So it's like mm-hmm. you'd have to get everyone to be a part of it and really take it, like, the same way it's like coming to the Oscars and what are you wearing and mm-hmm. you know who did the yeah. gown, and it would have to be the same thing. Because even mm-hmm. when you look at the, even with like the Met, like when they do the big thing at the Met,
mm-hmm.
the big thing is, what is, were they waiting to see Cardi B? They waiting to mm-hmm. see
yeah.
you know, Kanye and Kim Kardashian? It's mm-hmm. it's just like it'd have to be the same thing. Mm-hmm. Whatever we decide to right. do, you know,
mm-hmm.
but
it's hard. I mean, like, there's no real clear answers,
right?
Right. But I think answer number one is like saying, "Fuck that! I'm going to raise my fist. Fuck that! I'm going right. to, you know, wear my Black Lives Matter t-shirt yeah. if that's what I want to wear." Or
I just thought it was interesting that the Olympic Committee came out and said that about BLM, and didn't say that about Stop Asian Hate,
right?
Gay and Lesbian Alliance. I mean, they didn't say it about any of these other mm-hmm. things. It just like. Any of that,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
right, right.
So I, you know,
there's always been just a global
yeah.
assault yeah. on blackness.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And the Olympics saying that's them speaking for the world. That's not them speaking for just the
United. Exactly. Yeah. This the Olympics is the United Nations of sporting events.
Right.
So if they saying that, that's a united front that they have mm-hmm. amongst everybody. That no pro-black propaganda. We not
right.
going for
right. it. That's, yeah. And that's some scary shit.
Yeah.
You know?
So in turn, the black athletes probably shouldn't participate. But for some of them, this is the, all they have. And this is their right. biggest right. stage. So it's like, mm-hmm. you know, if I don't do this, then this don't happen. Then there's a domino effect to them mm-hmm. potentially boycotting.
Right.
Because nobody's not, Robert Smith or Jay-Z not going to step up and say, all right, well, I'm going to give you whatever you missed as a result of abstaining from participating in this blatantly racist institution.
It is like he said, it's just, it's many layers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All of, and like, sometimes mm-hmm. you got to go along to get along, unfortunately, yeah. and it sucks.
It's America.
It's America. It's America. So, kind of wrapping up, man, what can we look forward to from yourself and from Honeysuckle Projects, Honeysuckle Provisions for 2021 and beyond?
So, we're doing Black Labor Day again.
Awesome.
Which is also going to be our like grand opening for we're launching virtually as a virtual grocery store where people can pick up. We'll do drop offs and be shipping nationally. So that's the big thing.
Wow,
that's happening.
Wow, that's big.
Yeah. I'm excited for that. Other than that, man, I'm really trying to slow my life down because Sybil's expecting. Well, we're expecting June 9th.
Congratulations.
So, yeah. Thank you. So. Just trying to set up the homes.
People want to support the movement, donate to the GoFundMe. Where can they find you, find that link and stuff like that in order to be able to do so?
That would be GoFundMe. If you type in Honeysuckle,
it'll pop up.
Honeysuckle GoFundMe, it'll pop right up. Other than that, updates, you can look at Honeysuckle_projects on Instagram, Honeysuckle_provisions, which is the name of the actual concept. And then my personal page is Coltrane215.
Oh, yeah, I've seen it. All right. Yeah.
It all came full circle. Because
I've seen the name and I've been mm-hmm. on the page. In my mind, I just thought your page was.
There's not a lot of pictures of me on my page.
No, I'm just saying I thought it would be, you know, once you make it to where you're successful, you know, mm-hmm. I am Omar Tate. Like, I just mm-hmm. thought it would be something like the real Omar Tate or something. Like, I just.
You know, first thing I noticed once I, you know, was going through all of your different accomplishments and the media, I'm like, why isn't his page verified?
Oh.
They need to verify you.
Yeah, again, yeah. I think,
I mean, you don't do it more efficient than Time and Esquire.
Right. I'm really not sure how that works. You know? Are you verified?
No.
Okay.
I'm just a podcast.
They would never.
I'm trying. Yeah, get your dumb ass. Gordon, you out. Yeah, they got me up out of here.
On the drone where you can ask to be verified, and you give your information, and then it has the little message on. I typed in, I also have $50.
I'll pay.
Are any of those things real, like, to get verified?
Yeah, apparently, what people told me is they have to write articles about you.
Yeah, you have to have five verified articles, not Wikipedia. It has to be, you have to have a Wikipedia page plus five verified articles from real media publications.
I ain't got no Wikipedia page.
Or you can backdoor it, like you want to get your kid into Stanford for like
you can pay a guy that knows somebody that works at IG headquarters.
Get you in the side door.
Get you in the side door.
Maybe they'll hear this conversation and
we'll put it out there, man. Y'all need to verify
We're blowing up on YouTube.
Anything else that you feel like is relevant, important, or any message you want to deliver to the audience before we get out of here?
Oh, man. You want to be here for another 3 hours? Or
hey,
what?
Man, that's whatever. It's on you, brother.
No, man.
He's about to go in on this. About to be like a lemon pepper freestyle.
I used to write too, man. You know,
we all did.
I could see you actually writing some hot stuff. Yeah, I can believe it.
It was good. Yeah. But anyway, that's another like.
Yeah. I know you had some mean hollow bars.
Yeah.
Listen, man. That was a different time. I wasn't even rapping when I was in the Hollow. I spent a lot of time in West Philly, man. But like,
actually, when I was living in the Hollow, when I was growing up in the Hollow, I got shot, and a rapper named Spittish was murdered around that,
I remember Spittish.
So while we're on that topic, rest in peace, Tech N9ne, rest in peace, Spittish. I mean, I ain't been back there in a long time, but we grew up together and all that. So
I remember Spittish had a freestyle over the Lalo beat that I went crazy for back in the day. And if literally you said the first word right now, I could run that whole freestyle off.
Do you know Ali Cusses?
I used to. I grew up with him. I don't know him like that now, but yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah, it's a good friend of mine.
That's what's up, man.
Damn, Spittish. I remember that.
Yeah, you ain't heard that name in a long time.
Yeah,
right?
You've been around.
Anything you want to tell the people, share, anything, whatever. It could be whatever. You can say fucking police. I don't care. Like, whatever you want to, you want to say, man. We got a global audience, so before we wrap, I want to say we appreciate you for joining us today, coming on the show. Like I said in the beginning, you somebody that has transformed what it means to be involved in the culinary arts and just arts in general, especially coming from the inner city. You overcame a lot, and you've reached a very high height, but you still got a lot more growing to do. And we appreciate you coming through today.
Is your birthday tomorrow?
Thank you.
Sagittarius?
Nah,
I don't know.
Taurus.
I just guess all the time. Sometimes I don't fucking know.
Taurus. I mean, I don't really have a whole lot to say, man. I appreciate y'all, man. This was dope.
No doubt. Thank you.
Thanks for reaching out, man. I hope y'all get verified real soon.
Yeah. I hope so too.
And I want to see this thing grow, because I think, especially for Philly, like, this is something that's special.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, we're doing the groundwork. We've had a recent run of a lot of success, a lot of growth with the show, and somebody like you was definitely a good friend to have in the Rolodex, because, like I say, you got a lot more growing to do, and when you do,
I'm back. I'm back, man.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we need some claps for Omar Tate.
We need it.
this was very, very good. This is actually one of my favorite interviews.
Without a doubt, man. We appreciate your time. Thank you for coming through today.
Of course.
Make sure y'all support Honeysuckle Projects, Honeysuckle Provisions, Omar Tate. Follow him on the gram at Coltrane215. Everything spelled out correctly. And that's it, man. Rose Podcast ever. We out.
Yeah.
Peace.